From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we hear from a Brown Deer vocational teacher who has had to adjust how he's preparing students to enter the workforce. Then, in the high-stress time of COVID-19, how can healthcare workers take care of themselves?
They ask someone for help. They might be met with, oh, but you're the doctor, or you're a therapist, or you're someone that, you know, don't you know this stuff? And of course, that's not really reinforcing for them. And they also might develop this own sense of, yeah, aren't I supposed to know this?
And on its 10th anniversary, we discuss the impact of the Affordable Care Act, both good and not so good.
If you have benefits that are great if only people knew about them, to what extent are you really expecting that voters are going to be able to make sense of all of these things that are wrapped in this big, complicated package?
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. School closures present some unique challenges for vocational education teachers and their students. The hands-on learning central to technical education just isn't possible right now. But even though their last few months of training were cut short, a Brown Deer teacher is working with his high school seniors to arrange job placements in the construction field. Craig Griffey is a tech ed teacher at Brown Deer High School. He leads an industry advisory course with 12 students who are motivated to work in the construction field. During a normal school year, the students have job interviews with local companies and are hired for apprenticeships after graduation. But because of school closures, Griffey had to shift the way he prepares students for interviewing and getting into the workforce. WUWM education reporter Emily Files spoke with Griffey and one of his students, Stephen George. Griffey starts by explaining how his industry advisory course usually works.
These students are showing up to school on a voluntary basis 45 minutes before the school starts. And we have developed a program with the Carpenters Union where these students are learning how to do steel studs and drywall, which is the commercial style of framing out a building. And so they're showing up to learn this to give them a step up over maybe another young person applying for the job. And it teaches them the vocabulary, the tools, the methodology that they're using right now to build commercial buildings all over the area. And then at the end of the program, towards the end of the semester, we have a big interview day. Where every kid is guaranteed basically 4 interviews, and we're able to kind of match students up with an employer, and then they are able to start a registered apprenticeship right after high school if they so chose to do that.
Stephen, how did you get involved with the industry advisory program at Brown Deer High School?
My teacher, Ms. Kinder, introduced me to him. We was talking about my goals in life, and one of my goals was building my own house, and he introduced me to Mr. Griffey, gave me some outlets on some and insight on things, and then during down the class period, he introduced all of us to industry advisory, and when I heard about it, it was a no-brainer to just go forward.
Why was it a no-brainer for you?
All the opportunity that's come with industry advisory. And it enhances your skill. I used to do construction with my dad a lot. And, I thought I knew, the master way how to cut drywall. But, go there, that's not how you do it.
How you do it.
man. So even the little stuff I thought I knew, I mastered. I learned how to do it even better.
Mm-hmm. So when schools closed, what was your reaction, Craig?
Oh, no. What are we going to do? honestly, I was really sad for about a week. And that was really, really hard to kind of stomach this. And then, you got to move forward. And now this is an opportunity. I can't physically be in the same room with the kids anymore. My school is closed. And so we have we need to move, pivot and move forward to get these guys ready to interview.
Steve, I want to hear what your reaction was as a senior in your last semester when you found out that schools were shutting down and you might not even be back for the rest of the school year. What were your concerns?
Well, like every high school student, I say we was pretty happy because, you know, a break. But we was thinking like it's going to be like, you know, just for a week and then we'll be back. But then when it kept going and going, it's like, okay, we wanted a break from school, but we ain't mean like this now. You know, it was a hard challenge, especially with me. I'm not like, you know, big on technology and then electronic work. So it was a big struggle for me. I think it's the first time I ever wanted to be at school for real, for real.
How long did it take you to miss school?
It took about a week or two.
And like, what were your biggest concerns about what you might miss out on not being in school for your last couple months?
To be honest, Mr. Griffey class. No, I'm not even just saying that because he's right here either. I'd say that if he wasn't on here, Mr. Griffey class, I wanted to really be there for him.
Did you have concerns about finding a job after graduation?
No, not really. Because Mr. Griffey, not just saying that because he's right here. He's somebody you can trust. If he say you guaranteed a job, if you put 100% effort in something, he going to get you that job. So I wasn't really concerned about that.
So, Craig, that's what you tell students who take this class, that they're guaranteed a job if they put the effort in?
Boy, in the normal world, yeah. You know, it's part of the partnership we have with the Carpenters Union. And so, you know, part of putting the effort in is showing up on time and showing that you're ready to be employed. And, you know, our industry partners, I really value them because they have said, like, you know, if a kid is going to put the time in, we got to find a home for that kid. Because, you know, it comes down to the skills gap. And that is something that they are looking at every single day. You know, they're forecasting major shortages in welders and plumbers and electricians and carpenters and every trade across the board in the next few years here.
Craig, what questions or concerns were you hearing from your students when they found out that the school closure was going to last till the end of the year?
A lot of them were worried about what does this look like. A lot of students saying that we're bored. A lot of students want to start work tomorrow, and you know they can't start in these jobs until they graduate, and so we're just kind of caught in this waiting period right now. And I feel like there's a lot of built up excitement to get out and get started.
Before we talk about the interviews and what happened with those, What were you doing in terms of remote classes, remote education for this program? Was there anything that you could do in this format?
I mean, obviously I can't ship them all steel studs and drywall and have them frame something up in their garage. And so we switched to jobs interview and preparation. So we did a lot of resume work. We did a lot of practice interviewing.
Okay, so tell me about the job interview component of this program and how you adapted it with all of the restrictions that are in place right now.
We picked Zoom, not because of its security features, but because it's most accessible across the different platforms for students. And so we just set up a schedule. I talked with each of the contractors in advance, got a feel for what type of work they do, what type of workforce do they have, and what are they looking for. And out of the 12 students I had, I matched them up with what I believed would be, you know, the top five best matches for them, knowing that they might pick one out of it because of the economy. Then it just becomes a scheduling exercise where you have 12 kids, 12 contractors, everyone gets 4 or 5 interviews. And you want to just make sure that things run as smooth as possible and that everyone knows exactly what link to click in order to enter a Zoom room.
Got it. So, Stephen, how did the virtual interviews go for you?
They went real smooth. It seemed like some of them was like kind of nervous of talking to me because they said it was their first time doing the stuff too. So it was nice. It was cool.
What kind of questions did they ask you?
They asked like if I had, you know, any experiences doing a job. They asked what would be like my comfortable like availability if they was to hire me, and what interests me in carpentry. Why do I want to be? Things like that.
What were the results of the interviews for you, Stephen? Did you get a job offer?
Yeah, mine was good. I looking to sign with CG Schmidt, and that's going to the apprenticeship lab for about, I think, 4 years. And then that's when I become, you know, a journeyman, then keep leveling up in a business.
What is going on in terms of these companies, how they're feeling about hiring new employees? Craig, were any of these companies hesitant to offer jobs to students because of what's happening right now with the pandemic?
Yes. So it's on everyone's mind. I'm talking with these general superintendents and they're like, you know, Craig, we're losing a job a day. How can you expect me to take someone else on when I got five guys sitting on the bench and they're right. Like I can't expect them to bring anyone on. You know, some of the companies who interviewed, you know, they wanted to support this program. They wanted to see who these kids were and give them an interview. But then at the end of the day, they said, you know, I would bring this kid on, but I can't do it right now. And so what we're doing on our signing day is these kids will be signing conditional job offers. And so some of the job offers will say things like, we'll hire the worker by September 1st if the economy allows us to. Those details are being communicated with the kids. You know, in the end, what we're looking for with our contractors and our students is just to make sure that each student graduates knowing that they have a path forward in the industry. You know, I've been telling these kids there's over 20 million unemployed people right now. We're very lucky that we have a supportive industry that sees this as a way to address the skills gap and sees the value in investing in them.
And Craig, if next school year there are still some changes to the way things operate, like using more online classes or having to do social distancing at school in the classrooms, have you thought about how your career tech program could be affected in the future?
Yeah, I have. There's a lot of unknowns and it makes me nervous. I have the opportunity of having some time here to prepare for it. And one of my big questions for my industry partners is, you know, what are some online tools that you guys use that we could incorporate into our program and train virtually on? So that's the big open question I have right now.
Stephen, was there anything that you wanted to add from a student's perspective about what this program has meant for you or how you're kind of taking all of the changes in right now to education and the economy and what that might mean for you?
You pretty much covered it all. Like I said before, the learning and doing work on computers and stuff is kind of challenging. But, you know, the teachers, they like drill sergeants with this stuff. They make sure that you're on and they make sure you're doing your work. So, you know, it shows that they care about you. It shows that they care about your future. So they're making it, they're doing the best they can to make it easier for the students.
Mm-hmm. Craig, is there anything else that you want to add?
I'm proud of how the Brown Deer School District has allowed us to find innovative ways to partner up with the industry. Learning is so much more engaging. Learning is so much more real for students when we can contextualize it with like a real company and real jobs. You know, we've been able to change the culture at Brown Deer about looking at the trades as a career. COVID-19 stuff is going to challenge us to find new ways to partner and find new skills that we can teach in different ways to kids.
Greg Griffey is a tech ed teacher at Brown Deer High School, and Stephen George is one of his students. Griffey spoke with WUWM's education reporter, Emily Files. Griffey's students will participate in a virtual industry signing day on May 21st, where they'll accept job offers from local construction companies. Stephen George has already been offered an apprenticeship with C.G. Schmidt. Coming up next, how healthcare facilities can support employees who are vulnerable to PTSD. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Many healthcare workers risk their physical and mental health to do their jobs. The coronavirus pandemic has intensified these challenges. Healthcare workers are on the front lines treating COVID-19 patients, trying to help people survive, and witnessing these traumatic events. Research has found that just observing these kinds of events can be psychologically similar to experiencing them yourself. Clinical psychologist Dr. Chad Wetterneck says the medical community needs to pay greater attention to their employees and look out for symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. He says that proper support and coping tools are especially important in light of the pandemic. Dr. Wetterneck joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. She begins by asking how the medical community would have typically dealt with employee PTSD before the pandemic.
I think that probably varies greatly based on each location and how much they emphasize this. I would hope that they at least have some rudimentary, if you get exposed to very stressful events, you're likely to take on some of that stress. It's probably more common for people to get a debriefing after something major happens. So potentially maybe a loss of life that wasn't expected in their unit or something else that's pretty bad happening, for people to come in and do a debriefing on things that could happen as a result. But I think by and large, we probably do not have as much of a focus on having them understand what PTSD is and how they could contract it from their job.
So let's get into that a little bit. How is PTSD looking in the medical frontline community?
Yeah, and if I could just take that a little bit more broad, you know, most people when they hear post-traumatic stress disorder, they think of, you know, people that have been involved in combat and military situations. So there's a lot of, you know, people know that veterans are likely to encounter this and develop symptoms, but other types of traumas are just as likely to result in development of PTSD symptoms, things like motor vehicle accidents, near-death situations, physical assaults, sexual assaults, any sort of natural disaster, whether it's a hurricane, tornado in our area, or something else like an explosion, whether it's person-made or not. So someone has to encounter something that they felt like either their life or the life of someone around them was compromised to the point of where they could have lost their life. People generally feel really helpless and afraid. They have a limbic system response where they either want to fight, flight, or actually freeze, where they don't do anything at all. And then in our medical centers, they're likely to see, especially if they work in, let's say, like a trauma unit or even in the ER or something like that, you're going to get people who probably had something like that happen to them. You're seeing the after effects of this. So they're going to be exposed to like the aftermath of a trauma, and people could also develop symptoms just by seeing the aftermath of a trauma as well.
Obviously, change in mood and thoughts can look different in everyone, but in a work environment that's so stressful and high risk, such as a hospital ICU right now or a COVID floor, you know, how can things like this not simply be brushed off or attributed to how people are acting just during that shift? Because it goes beyond that.
Sure. And I think we have to realize a few things. So I'm talking about some of the worst case scenarios here. And I also want to mention that most people who experience a trauma do not go on and develop PTSD. So they don't have all the symptoms, or if they do have some symptoms, they can be temporary because, of course, it was scary or potentially a loss of life where there's some grief involved. And sometimes the activities they do after that or time heal some of those kind of like psychological wounds. So I don't want to make it sound like everyone's going to develop this. This is actually, you know, more the exception than the norm. And going back a little bit more to your question, people probably need to adjust to more stressful times and will look different than what their baseline is for their mood and behavior. And we have to accept that as a potential normal response. And that in this time, maybe what we need to do is be even more, while I'm doing my job, still be grounded and detached from the actual stress of it. What we need to be able to recognize is whether or not that's now carrying over into their home life, or if they are, you know, in down periods of time at work, if there are such things, are they still different than what their baseline is, where they appear much more distant, much more kind of like pessimistic about things? Maybe it's they don't do things that they relied upon before for coping skills. You know, some people might take a walk during lunch and they're no longer doing that. They're no longer communicating with their peers quite as much. So some of this is a normal response, but we have to see how much it generalizes to all areas of what they do.
So it's kind of a little difference between using tools for desensitizing yourself as a way to get through things versus taking that to the next level of, would you say, feeling numb?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's one way to look at it. And I think we're trying to look and see whether or not are people trying to stay in kind of a protective mode all the time, or are they still willing to not only do things for themselves, but share things that could be a little bit more vulnerable to them so that they can actually kind of process some of the things that they're experiencing, which also then lets other people know, hey, I need support. And then you're more likely to get that support when you're willing to share those things.
You know, there's a saying that doctors are some of the worst patients. So how important is it to seek help and to encourage them seeking help and monitor not just themselves, but each other during this time?
I think it's really important. I don't think we can state that enough. And I've heard that saying many times before as well. And I think, you know, we're dealing with some stigmas here that I think there's a general stigma of mental health that comes up where, depending on how you were raised in your environment, whether it supported talking about feelings or emotions or reaching out for help, that's one element of it. And then there's this, this phenomena of medical and mental health providers, you know, being viewed as, well, you know about how to stay healthy, whether it be physical or mental health. And I think that actually, they'll hear that from people. You know, if they ask someone for help, they might be met with, oh, but you're the doctor, or you're a therapist, or you're someone that, you know, don't you know this stuff? And of course, that's not really reinforcing for them. And they also might develop this own sense of, yeah, aren't I supposed to know this? Am I supposed to present with an aura of kind of like confidence and being an expert here? And sometimes, again, that generalizes to an unhealthy effect, to where they, you know, they might be willing to sit with symptoms longer than they should or not get them addressed at all.
The worst example that we have seen is the ICU nurse in New York that committed suicide. So obviously there's, as you mentioned, there's a big spectrum here with how people are being affected and dealing with it. So how is mental health treatment adapting to meet this need? You know, speaking specifically to Wisconsin area healthcare workers and mental health care providers, you know, how is that extra outreach being accomplished? And obviously there's a greater need for it, but do you see that need being expressed like it should be?
Well, I think in some places they're starting to meet the needs, and in other areas they could definitely do more work. When I look at things on a system level versus more like a national level, each organization I think has an obligation to try to improve things where they're making sure they're hearing their employees, what are their current concerns, and also is their organization listening to like the local and national experts on what should we be doing to take care of ourselves? Are they protecting them in some way, especially in hospital settings? Are they using personal protective equipment? Do they have access to that? Do people have worries about whether or not they're going to have access to that? Do they feel like they have the preparation or training for this as well? What do they need to know to still do their job effectively? And then it's like the support piece. And I think that's the one that, you know, there's a, we want to be as helpful as possible, but there's sometimes these boundaries between how much are we infringing on someone's personal life and their thoughts and their, you know, mental health in our work environments. And I think people feel like they have to kind of like balance that. I mean, everyone wants healthy employees, but they don't want to make someone have to get help or talk about these things because it probably violates some privacy laws and other things in organizations. What I see on like a larger level is I see a lot of more national organizations trying to offer seminars, webinars, trying to get people to understand how it affects them, sometimes very broadly, sometimes more specific in specific roles that they're in. I know that in the organization that I work in, one thing that we've done, we've set up things like, smaller self-care sessions where we can just talk openly about things with the purpose being not to vent about what's wrong, but more to be able to hear each other, but give support, help problem solve certain things, be able to point out what we still are in control of. I mean, when we're in this challenging environment, we need to be able to focus on what is actually under our control. We're not going to ignore the other things, but if we over-focus on those uncontrollables, that's going to lead us to feel helpless. I don't know that case fully about the person that took their own life, but typically when those situations arise, it's because people feel like, I don't know how else to try to solve what's going on right now. I feel helpless. I don't see hope. And in those situations, we want to let people know there are some things that people can still do to try to have control within their job and also what they do when they go home.
So what do you see as the long-term impact on these workers way down the line after we manage to control the pandemic and eventually have a vaccine and these measures aren't necessary? But how is this period of time, for however long it lasts, going to impact these workers as they carry on?
I think that's going to greatly depend on how they are trying to work through what's going on right now. And I think we have to consider that even if some states or certain areas are saying, you know, we can go back to normal times fairly soon, I think in our minds, we realize that it could be much longer than that. And it would be more healthy for us to think not that things are going to go back to normal anytime soon, but that I need to try to bring aspects of what was coping for me before this happened into my current day-to-day regimen and routine, because I don't know when this could end. So I'm not going to just wait for it to end to go back to doing things that were even more healthy for me. If they don't do that, I do think that the long-term impact is when people get stressed, they not only develop some mental health issues, they're more likely to have wear and tear on their body. Their cortisol levels are going to be high in stressful situations. And once a situation passes, but you've had a long time of that cortisol level activation, that's when you're actually more susceptible to getting sick, to feeling down. And we don't know how long this is going to last, where they have to keep that kind of like stress response going. So those that are able to implement a more healthy regimen are more likely to come out of this kind of being able to have the perspective of, I developed some resiliency. That was incredibly challenging, but I made it through, and I hope it doesn't happen again. And those that don't adapt are the ones that are more likely to develop different physical and mental health conditions and maybe even question if they want to be in this field.
With the workers who are in the, you know, the heat of COVID, and with hospital policies not allowing visitors, you know, they're surrounded by death and they have the additional task of being the only source of contact and comfort for patients and facilitating family connections with their personal phones, even for FaceTime and things like that. So that's a big additional weight that is affecting them.
Yeah, it is. And I think this comes under the people need training for this. So even in medical settings where people may end up dying, more times than not, there's probably some family that can be called, that can come on the scene, that maybe were already there because they know that there was either an accident or perhaps it was something that was expected to happen in the next couple of days. And they'll need more support than usual during those times. It'll be important for them to find a trusted, safe outlet for them to be able to talk about what happened. And I know, and this isn't really a stigma, but it's part of our job in both physical and mental health locations to still be confidential about what happened at our workplace. that doesn't mean we can't come home and tell a friend or a significant other, I just had a really tough day and, you know, a patient lost their life, or I had to make a really, really difficult phone call or facilitate this message to someone. That's enough for another person that cares about you typically to understand and offer some support there. But I do think each organization needs to do what they can to try to prepare them for this either happening or happening more often than it has in the past.
You mentioned some tips for personal coping and well-being. So expanding upon that, what would you recommend that organizations do for these workers?
Well, and you know, without telling people exactly what to do, they could still have emails and reminders and signs up about making sure, first of all, they're taking care of their basic needs. So, you know, I often use this reference that not a lot of people know, but Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which, you know, kind of talks about what do people need to function. And on a very basic level, people need things to eat, they need things to drink, they need sleep. So to be able to emphasize that even in a really stressful job, you know, when people get caught up and they're either actively saving life or otherwise, I mean, maybe 6 hours pass and they realize, oh yeah, lunch was 3 hours ago, but I was kind of occupied. It's making sure that they're instructing their employees to still do things that give them that physical health aspect of basic needs. And then there's a lot of emotional needs that we need to try to promote. And I think it's fair for our organizations to say, we want you to do things that will actually be able to get you in touch with periods of calm in your life. Another thing I'd recommend is, you know, having them ask, what did they used to do to try to deal with stress and anxiety, or even to improve their mood? What were their previous coping skills? And I think having lists of things that people frequently do for coping skills would be really helpful. You know, obviously sleeping would be helpful, but stretching, walking, doing yoga, just taking some time to rest, engaging in things that involve like showing compassion for yourself and other people. Part of that could be just recognizing all of the stress and emotional reaction you're having. It's normal. This is a higher stress time. There's nothing wrong with you that you're feeling this way. This is more challenging even for non-mental and physical health workers because everyone's contemplating like death and sickness more than they would usually. So don't over-pathologize yourself. Don't assume that it means there's something wrong. Think about the people that you trust the most in your life. And this could be a very relative term, but talk to them, tell them some of your fears and let them offer you some comfort. Now that's not ever in everyone's wheelhouse, but if you can take steps toward that, it's going to be better than doing nothing at all.
All right. Well, Dr. Chad Wetternick, thank you so much for joining me today and talking about this very important topic.
All right. Thank you, Audrey. I like doing it and I hope it's helpful for folks.
Dr. Chad Wetternick is a clinical psychologist and clinical director of trauma recovery services at Rogers Behavioral Health. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Affordable Care Act turns 10 this year. The landmark legislation has had a huge impact on the way healthcare operates in the United States. More than 20 million people have health insurance as a result of the ACA, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Still, since it passed in 2010, the ACA has faced challenges that threaten its efficacy. Today, as the country grapples with a pandemic, there are questions about the kind of care this legislation guarantees and its limitations. Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and an expert on public policy. Earlier this year, he wrote a paper examining the ACA for the journal Health Affairs. Rocco joined me in the studio in March, just before the Safer at Home order was in place. Philip Rocco, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Hey, great to be here, Joy.
Before the ACA, what was insurance like in the United States?
Yeah, so before the Affordable Care Act, the number of people with health insurance had been slowly declining really since the 1970s. And one of the reasons this is that employers were facing higher and higher costs for medical care, right, as medical inflation went up. And at the same time, the number of people who were protected by labor unions was decreasing. And so gradually insurers like lost the incentive that they had to maintain that coverage ERISA was a law which allowed some insurers to self-insure. So they pulled out of larger group plans, created their own plans. And so you started to see greater instability in these larger risk pools. And so over time, fewer and fewer people had insurance from their employers, which is really sort of was supposed to be the backbone for working age Americans, the way that the federal government sort of subsidized health insurance for employers beginning in the 1940s. It was really supposed to be the backbone, but by the 1990s, that had really began to crater. And so what many Americans without insurance, my grandparents, for example, who had a small business, had to buy plans on the very, very limited individual marketplace, because most people didn't buy the plans until they were sick. Premiums were sky high. These plans also had a number of restrictions on coverage for people with pre-existing conditions, including kids with like chickenpox, for example. In some cases, there are all kinds of horror stories you can go back and look at. And of course, Medicaid, which is now we think of as a program that covers about 1 in 5 Americans. Many low-income Americans receive health insurance through Medicaid. It was a plan that was much more restricted to select sort of populations, people with disabilities, low-income seniors who had needed help with 2 or more activities, daily living, things like that. The system was even more fragmented than it is presently.
So how did the Affordable Care Act respond, essentially, to a lot of these exclusions, a lot of the issues that we had with these health insurance plans before this piece of legislation was ultimately crafted?
So one way of thinking about it is for many years prior to the Affordable Care Act, in fact, most of the 1970s, 1980s, and early 1990s, the emphasis on what national health insurance should look like was a reform that made the system universal. Medicare for All, effectively, was on presidential platforms for Jimmy Carter. Even Richard Nixon supported this. But there's a real change in the political economy of health insurance, especially in the 1990s, insurers became a really powerful lobby against this sort of comprehensive reform. Pharmaceuticals, as well, had become a really sort of powerful and entrenched lobby to prevent that kind of systemic reform. And so in 2010, the strategy of the Obama administration and Democratic leaders in Congress was that rather than try to get through that gauntlet of interest group politics to actually bring in what had been historical opponents of comprehensive reform and actually make them into some of the authors of the legislation. So key provisions of the ACA were written by America's health insurance plans, written by pharma lobbyists, written by these sort of interests. Now, in the end, not all of these sectors signed on to the legislation. So for example, the insurance industry started out as a partner, but ultimately bailed because the ACA had some provisions that restricted insurers from charging people more based on their age, the so-called community rating provisions. But the general strategy of the ACA was rather than remaking the system to try to fill in the gaps in coverage that people experienced. So on the one hand, taking this individual marketplace, which had been incredibly limited and prohibitively costly, and providing subsidies to insurers and people who didn't qualify for Medicaid so that they could purchase insurance on the individual marketplace. On the other hand, take Medicaid and expand coverage to all individuals with incomes of up to 138% of the federal poverty level, which is in individual person terms about $17,000 per person today. And then to take some other steps to restructure the rules around what insurers had to cover, covering people with pre-existing conditions, adult children being able to be on their parents' insurance till the age of 26, a variety of sort of individual market reforms, and then thousands of pages of other provisions designed to, you know, sort of reform the way that care is delivered and paid for by Medicare and Medicaid. So in a way, it was an approach to reform that wasn't about systemic transformation, but about sort of plugging in some of the gaps in coverage.
What are some of the most notable gaps that have been filled as a result of the ACA?
So one way of thinking about this is that the ACA accounts for about 20 million more Americans receiving coverage. And some of those key gaps that have been filled, I think, are really at the lower end of the income distribution, people who qualify for Medicaid because they live at 138% of the federal poverty level or less. Of course, because of the Supreme Court's 2012 ruling in a case called NFIB versus Sebelius, states didn't have to expand Medicaid. States could opt in. So a lot of states chose not to opt in to Medicaid expansion, and about 14 states still have not opted in at one level or another. And so in many ways, that gap is filled, but it depends on where you live. The individual marketplace was supposed to be a sort of crucial gap-filling measure for people living above 138% of the federal poverty level, but still lower middle-income folks. But those plans remain quite expensive depending on where you are. Insurers have had varying incentives to come in and stick around in the marketplace. And the premiums in those plans, as well as the cost sharing in those plans, can remain prohibitively costly for a lot of people. And so the ACA, you can think about it as vastly reducing the number of people without any coverage at all. But there are a number of people who remain underinsured, meaning they're spending a significant portion of their annual income on the care that they need, either through premiums or cost sharing.
You know, you mentioned 14 states have not expanded Medicaid. I believe we're in one of those states.
Yeah, that's right. Wisconsin has not expanded Medicaid. There was a move during the Walker administration to change Wisconsin's Medicaid waiver to expand coverage up to 100% of the federal poverty level within Badger Care. So it was sort of a punt, an attempt to do something else. But no, we haven't expanded Medicaid in Wisconsin.
For states that have expanded Medicaid, what has that ultimately meant for their coverage?
I mean, coverage has expanded pretty dramatically in states that expanded Medicaid. And I think this has impacts not just for individuals. It certainly does. Health outcomes have changed significantly. There's been a measurable decrease in mortality rates among a variety of populations within Medicaid in states that have expanded it. But also, it has had a huge effect on hospitals. So the amount of care that is uncompensated in hospitals has been drastically reduced in states that expanded Medicaid.
So it's ultimately been helpful for hospital systems.
You can think about it as something that has helped to sustain and even solidify the infrastructural capacity of hospitals, especially in rural areas.
I was about to say, that seems significant because we know there are a lot of rural hospitals that are having a lot of financial difficulties.
Yeah, and I think this is something that remains an issue for rural hospital systems. The limited population, the fact that it can be difficult to staff key departments in the hospital, these all contribute to real infrastructural challenges, even if it's something that's not causing the hospital to have real organizational or fiscal problems today. It's something that people are worried about. And so that is something that I think you can see the Medicaid expansion is having one sort of primary impact, not just on individuals' ability to get insurance, but like what we think of as the health infrastructure that we live in. And that infrastructure matters not only for the people who have Medicaid or Medicare or coverage financed through some part of the ACA, but people who just need to go to the hospital, right, if there's some kind of emergency.
So going back to some of the provisions inside of the ACA, you know, there are certain ones that I certainly didn't know about before they came into play in my life. We were just talking about this before the interview. I had to get a number of vaccinations recently, and I found out they were $0 because they were suggested by the CDC. What are some of these lesser-known provisions that have come out of the ACA that have a big impact?
Yeah, I think the essential health benefits is one of the big ones. It is, you know, the sort of protections for treatments, preventative treatments that are recommended by the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, things like vaccine, right? Those are really important, but there's something that you don't recognize until you need it. $11 billion for community health centers, which in a city like Milwaukee provide a crucial, absolutely essential part of our health infrastructure here. Also, just the idea that primary care is something that there should be an essential health benefit, something that getting a preventative screening, a checkup, you know, your annual wellness visit, that should be something that you don't have to pay a significant amount of money for cost sharing or out-of-pocket expenses for. All of these sort of hidden benefits are something that make the ACA, you know, potentially like surprisingly good, but they're also something that I think creates a political risk for the law. If you think about Social Security, when it passed, people got a Social Security card, right? They knew quite simply that they would be eligible for a public pension at a certain point in time when they retired. Same thing with Medicare, right? When you reach a certain age, you just become eligible. These benefits are all fairly legible to the public. The ACA would have been difficult to describe in that way. In fact, you know, there's now this like body of experts and scholars that like make a living on translating the ACA for like a public audience. It's a patchwork of many, many different reforms. That means that in the earliest years of the law, it was very, very difficult for people to understand the ways in which it benefited them. And the law itself didn't make it easy to do. And so when you look at, for example, like public opinion on the ACA, it's divided really along partisan lines until there's a threat of repeal. And suddenly the benefits of the ACA become more visible because there's a possibility that they're going to be taken away. And patients, physicians, a number of other advocacy groups begin raising the legibility of these benefits, and suddenly they become clear. But this is sort of one lesson of policy reform, which is that if you have benefits that are great if only people knew about them, well, to what extent are you really expecting that voters are going to be able to make sense of all of these things that are wrapped in this big, complicated package? You know, are you really expecting reform to be politically sustainable if its core beneficiaries don't even know that they're beneficiaries?
Yeah. There's been a lot of confusion right now with coronavirus, with COVID-19, about what is covered by insurance, what should be covered by insurance, and what mechanisms we have inside of the ACA to deal with pandemics.
I mean, so there was an announcement by the Trump administration yesterday, I think, that said that the COVID-19 test would qualify as an essential health benefit under the ACA. But still, large employer health plans have to cover the benefit of preventative testing, but those tests don't have to be free, right? And if you think about it, one reason for this confusion and this lack of clarity is that the ACA didn't replace this very fragmented system of payers and providers that exists in the United States. That question, will you be able to get the test for free? Not a question in the United Kingdom that has a national health service, right? Not a question in Taiwan. Not a question in countries that sort of guarantee a certain minimum of health benefits as a sort of citizenship right. The fact that we still live in a pretty fragmented architecture for health coverage is one thing that contributes to this, because you have to go out looking for information. Am I going to be covered? Will this test be free? And that search for information from a sort of like consumer's perspective, although I like to think about people as patients, not consumers, it actually can inhibit people from maybe getting tested if they feel that that would be a good idea.
So this gets actually back to one of my big questions about the Affordable Care Act. What are the limitations of this piece of legislation?
I think the limitations of the Affordable Care Act are ironically related to what made it a political strength in, you know, 2010, which is it was designed to be a piece of legislation that would move through the institutional gauntlet of interest group politics, right? And the idea is don't rock the boat, fill in the gaps, deal with some of the worst exigencies created by the American healthcare system, and you will have a piece of legislation that will be a signature, landmark, historic piece of legislation. But sometimes what is good legislative politics doesn't make good health policy, right? And I think this is as true for Democrats in many ways who are trying to get a piece of legislation through the gauntlet as it is for Republicans who are sitting in state legislatures thinking about, am I going to be primaried if I vote for Medicaid expansion, And I think some of the biggest limitations of the ACA is that it really doesn't deal with some of the forces in the economy of healthcare that make healthcare persistently unaffordable for many people. It doesn't deal with the fact that prices are a significant driver of cost. And there's really no significant price control mechanisms within the Affordable Care Act. Those things are sort of left on the table. We don't allow Medicare, for example, to negotiate for drug prices, is one commonly heard refrain about some of these limitations. Another way of seeing it is that the Affordable Care Act doesn't tackle what are some of the most significant inequalities in the way that we allocate healthcare. And the kind of care that you receive depends not just on what age you are, where you fall in the income distribution, whether or not you qualify for various means-tested forms of care, but also, in some cases, who you work for, how stable that work is, and if you are covered in the individual marketplace, do you happen to live in a place where there is robust competition that drives down premiums, or do you live in a place where the risk pool is disproportionately made up of people who need a lot of care? And I find this as a scholar very difficult, because sometimes you get asked a very reasonable question: what's been the effect of the Affordable Care Act on coverage? And my answer has to be this very annoying, pointy-headed, scholarly answer, which is, well, that depends on, you know, where you live and what insurance market you're in. But that, to me, is an index of what some of the gaps and inadequacies left by the Affordable Care Act are.
Yeah. Well, Philip Rocco, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and an expert on public policy. He wrote a paper examining the 10-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act for the journal Health Affairs. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.